Good evening, one and all. A Tuesday and another week and another show with me, Barry. Another book and a chat for you to hopefully enjoy anyway. Well, start of another week. I'm the eldest of three. I've got two younger sisters. Definite disadvantage earlier on in life, but a definite advantage later on in life with two younger sisters. But that's another story. But they say when you get in groups like that, that the eldest one always gets the blame, and the youngest one gets spoiled, and the middle one gets neglected, things like that. But what about if that wasn't quite the case? If there wasn't, even though you, there wasn't a one, you weren't the first one, but you still classed as the first one. Well, it's a bit confusing, I know, but my guest today, she's going to explain a bit about that and about the issues that such things brought up. What can I say about her? She's a award-winning English professor, award-winning as in Outstanding Woman of the Year and Distinguished Teacher of the Year. She's offered lots of workshops on this sort of thing for, and writers to help find their voices. And now she's written her story in a fascinating book. But I better introduce her, haven't I? Because on the show today, I have the one and only Barbara Jaffe. Hi, Barbara. How are you doing?
Very well. Thank you, Barry, for having me on your show. I'm honored.
It's a pleasure. Oh, I'm sorry because you know, you were due to be on early on in the year before I started all the whoops, falling on the snow, crack me head, concussion, medical issues. Yep.
I heard about that. I'm so glad you're on the mend.
Yeah, I'm every week's a bit better. You know, it's one of these things that you can't put a date on it. It's sometimes I feel great and then I go and stand up and the whole room starts swaying again. You know, but it's such is life. You have to keep going and that's all you can do, which indeed is a little bit like your book. But let's go back and explain. It all started and your book it basically is a replacement child's journey to healing. When will I be good enough? Basically is the title of it. Now, people say, what's a replacement child? Can you explain, because obviously you know, it's your book and everything, can you explain what that means?
Absolutely. So in a literal sense, a replacement child is someone who's born specifically to replace a child in a family that's passed away. So most of the time, the family was content on the blueprint it had, was not planning to have any more children, and then sadly, unforeseenly, of course, a child dies and the parents decide to have another child, which was the case with me. I have an older brother, and then I had another brother who died when he was about two, and then I was born after him to replace him.
So it's like an unplanned child that turns out to be have to be planned to replace, you know, some traumatic incident that's happened within the family almost.
Correct. Absolutely. And so while I grew up, I never thought of myself as a replacement child, but as I got older and more introspective, I realized that there were areas of my life that just quite didn't fit. I was having a lot of challenges, and I kind of wondered often why I was so competitive with myself, why I didn't feel good enough in many areas. And I came to realize that that for me was my foundation, trying to please my mother, understanding even before I could articulate with words that I wanted to make her happy, and truly it was my life's mission to do so because I sensed her deep depression.
Exactly, that's what I was going to say. So yeah, like people say that children can sense spirits and ghosts and other things like that. You could, as a child, sense your own mother's, there was something wrong with your mother, that there was something not quite right. Not the fact that the business of, you know, don't talk about such things in front of the children. I expect that sort of happened a couple of times as well.
Right. And my mother actually did not want to talk about my brother Jeffrey's passing. She had pictures around the house but did not want to talk about it. My father would talk about it if I asked him, but it was pretty much a taboo subject.
Now, see, you do hear a lot of people who are adopted, and you know, there's people write about that, about, you know, growing up and not realizing that they weren't their own parents and this sort of thing. You know, hear about that all the time. But this is something that you don't really hear so much about.
It's true. There's just been recent work that has been done. There's one other book called Replacement Child, and then there's a book by Abigail Brenner on the idea of the replacement child unconscious scripts. And there came to be research done on the replacement child syndrome, some qualities, some personality traits that define a replacement child. And while I don't necessarily like to pinhole myself as such, when reading that, I did feel that so many of those qualities were mine, and it did make a lot of sense.
Now, the fact that you were a girl after two boys,
yes,
must have been even more awkward for them, because they were, you know, it was like, wonderful, we finally got a daughter, but there was still this sense of loss that left, I guess, your mother's heart with a great big hole in it.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, that's totally understandable. And while she did tell me many times that she was happy that she had a girl, as you said, after two sons, I think it was really hard for her to relate to me in that way, and she was much more comfortable with males, or that was my perspective, definitely.
Do you think your mother had this sort of image of what she wanted her daughter to be, and that all the time, do you feel like you were trying to live up to something that just wasn't there, or was like an image, not really you?
Yes, and I don't necessarily attribute that to Jeffrey's passing, because, again, he was only two, and I have done some reading on replacement children where the children were older when they died, and literally they were living in their shadow. But I think for my mother, because she had never really dealt with the grief, and I think the key here is communication, she didn't work through it. Mm-hmm. And so, not that one ever gets over the loss of a child, so she brought that into our relationship, and, you know, it was an impossibility in terms of my role to make her happy.
Did it, was it worse on special occasions, you know, I don't know, graduation and school things and stuff like that? Did you sort of sense in her that, yes, she's there looking at you, but I should have been seeing my son graduate and stuff like that?
I don't think that I got that feeling, but I was more of a trailblazer, and she would often be mystified as to what propelled me to do so many things when adequacy was fine with her, kind of mediocrity was just fine. So I think that she found me to be perplexing in that way, because I was just striving constantly for more.
And in that striving, did you sort of realize that you could perhaps help mend broken pieces, if you like, of your mother?
I realized that was an impossibility, but I certainly came to understand that I could mend the broken pieces in myself. So initially,
yourself,
when I wrote the book, yes, I felt for myself that the book was very cathartic, and it was an important part of my journey. And as I read it, and I would share some pages with friends, they could relate. And while they weren't replacement children, I think so many of us in some time of our life feel less than enough, whether it's in work or in family life, in education. And so that was the universality of my writing that has really spoken to readers.
Yeah, and it comes over time and time again. You get lots of people, you know, with abuse and illness and stuff like that on the show.
Yeah.
And when they write the book, it's a healing process for themselves, and in sharing what's happened to, you know, their life, what's happened to them with other people. That it's almost like a shock sometimes that other people can relate to it, because once you've written it, it's like, I wrote this to heal me. But really, then somebody sends you an email or something and says, you know, oh my goodness, you must know my life, I've gone through the same sort of thing. Did you get a bit of a shock when people started sort of commenting back to you?
I really did. And then that made me see that although my unique perspective is through the lens of a replacement child. I saw the universality, as I said, children who perhaps were adopted, or children in families where they're compared with their siblings,
yes.
which is a common thing
yes.
that parents yes. do. Like, this one is good in sports, or
yep.
this one is the model, or this one is academic. And we tend to do that sometimes without even thinking and how damaging it can be. And those were the readers that pretty much everyone that said, well, that was the area of my life that I just never felt that I measured up.
Yeah, I mean, it's all, I mean, every day you hear it, you know, we never got this trouble with your homework with your brother or your sister, or,
right.
oh, your sister was sleeping through the night when she was 3 months and you kept me awake for 3 years, sort of thing. You know, it's an everyday thing, and you don't realize that some of these comments can actually hurt the person.
Absolutely. That's right. We don't realize that.
And obviously, when going through this and growing up with this, what effect did it have on you? You know, like, I don't know, self-confidence and all that sort of stuff.
I think for me, the areas of my self-confidence, my self-esteem, and my self-worth were greatly affected. And while I never really realized it in one aha moment, your question about what times of my life were hard, for me, it was when I was newly married, or when I became a mother, or when I decided that I wanted to pursue a career. All what I like to call the big ticket items.
Right.
Those were the areas where the self-worth, self-esteem, self-confidence just kind of reared its head.
When did you start along a healing path? Did you sort of realize that, you know, this is about time I faced up to this and got to grips with this, or just was it a gradual healing process?
I wish that I could have one of those, you know, going to the mountain and having one of these aha moments that would just be so transformational. But for me, like most things in my life, have been just like a slow IV drip of understanding. And that was the case. Although I have to say I was on a quest for knowledge and understanding from the time that I left my home to go away to school, college. And in the 70s, there were encounter groups, there was EST, there were lots of different ways in which to delve inward and the metaphysical areas. And that's what I chose to do. And then later on, when as I was older, I sought therapy, I sought meditation, I sought various ways in which to come to terms and to find answers. I don't think people on the outside would notice that there was anything, but on the inside I just felt that I was like a salmon swimming upstream.
Right. In When Will I Be Good Enough, your book, do you go into some of the ways that you sort of evolved, if you like, into your own person and got through this?
I do. I begin the book with the first chapter, which is a young girl slowly disappearing. And that was literally and emotionally, in that I write about my eating issues, my anorexia,
mm-hmm.
and as a way of establishing control in my relationship with my mother. And I end with the chapter where I'm beginning to put myself back together. The way I look at my book is really kind of, I take myself apart, I examine the pieces, and I put myself back together in what I like to call a beautiful tapestry that we all have. And of course, for me, the message is we all have challenges in life, we all walk with something, but that doesn't mean we can't have a beautiful, fulfilling life.
Exactly. I mean, everybody has their paths to go down and their trials and tribulations, and some more so than others, but you know,
absolutely,
there's no reason why we can't go through, you know, get through this and come out the other side a better person, which obviously, you know, within your book, that's something you must share with people.
And I do, yeah. And yes.
And talking about sharing, what sort of response have you received from the book?
A universality of acceptance and understanding, and a lot of people said that it took tremendous courage, and I am the first to admit that there are people who have had many more challenging experiences in their lives, But somebody said to me once, well, they didn't write about it, and you did. And I thought, well, I guess that's true.
That's right.
And so the understanding that they may, as I said, they may not have been a replacement child, but they had an understanding that it really affected them in a positive way. I give the example of the burnt toast syndrome when I was a young mother. It was my understanding that I had to sacrifice everything for my children. Mm. And it went as far as the food, you know. So if there was a piece of toast that I burnt, I would take the burnt one, the leftovers, the things that one would throw out perhaps or use as croutons, and give everybody else the better one when I was salivating for the good stuff. And then as I evolved, I come to realize that I deserved the same as everybody else. That's a kind of a metaphor for my evolution.
And it's funny, the adverts that you see on television, you know, first baby very delicately carrying it home, and, you know, and every time the baby moves, that people wake up and stuff like that. Second baby, here you go, Grandma. That's it.
That's true.
It is. With the book and everything like that, is there a follow-up possibly coming, sort of, you know, how it was there and perhaps moving into your own family and how it's enabled you to work with them better or something?
I think for me it's more of a global area of reflections, be able to look at the world through the lens that I have been viewing life, because I'm able to see a lot of universalities, even though I might have had different experiences with someone else. That's been very well received. I've been asked to write for Psychology Today and InnerSelf.com, and the journals have been well received for that very reason. The understanding of being able to look at something kind of like Nora Ephron, maybe not obviously as funny as she, mm-hmm. but the ability to look at life that we all experience and just name it and write about it.
And that's the thing. If you, I mean, you write something and you see people, or you're reading it, or you see people reading it and stuff like that, and they start nodding, yeah, you know, I've been there. And I have it on the show all the time, you know, somebody says something about something, and I'm sitting here nodding, thinking, you know, I'm sitting here in a room by myself. Who's going to see me on the radio? Who's going to see me nodding my head, you know? It's true. I mean, people, in a way, a lot of people who've written about, you know, abuse, perhaps religious or sexual abuse, for instance, right? They put their story in a fiction novel and base it around them. And it's based around their story. But when people read it and they've been through a similar thing, they are putting themselves in the place of the main character. And with your book, I would say the same. There are people reading it who are sitting there nodding their head, reading it, saying, yep, I went through that. I can remember my mother doing that, or how I felt after that happened. And that's something you must really, you know, it comes over, I guess.
Yes, one of my colleagues, in fact, when she read it, she just was in awe, because one of the things my mother would often say is, I don't know what I got to deserve this, whatever this meant at the time. And her mother used to say the exact same things to her, and she hadn't thought about it until she started to read the passage, and she was just like, you know, awestruck.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's true, and you look back. I mean, you don't remember these things when they're said, unless of course, you know, it's something that scars you or sticks in your mind. It's just something that's said in a family thing or something like that, and years, decades afterwards, something come up and you think, yes, I used to say that. I remember my mother saying that, or, you know, I can remember that my parents sort of, don't say anything, the children might hear, sort of thing, as I said at the beginning.
Yes, that's right. We have so much in common, even though we are all very different in our unique experiences, and it's that commonality that I see that readers gravitate toward.
Right. The book's out. One of the things that's come up, and I mean, with your literary background, English background and stuff like that, was it still a surprise to you that when you think you've done the hard work and published the book and it's there in your hand, that's when the work really starts to get the book out there?
It shouldn't surprise me, Barry, but it was a complete surprise. And And the irony is not lost on me as an English professor where I teach writing and tell my students it is an iterative process, writing and rewriting and rewriting. So many of my students think that once they, you know, take it out of the computer, out of the printer, it's done.
Yeah.
And so the book took me about 2 years to write and another 2.5 years to rewrite. So I remind my students all the time, you could literally write one paper for the entire semester if that's what we chose, which we wouldn't because it would be far too boring for them. But yes, that totally surprised me.
Wow. See, even somebody with your experience in the subject, it surprises me. The days have gone. I was, 20, 30 years ago, you got to be the publisher and then they did the stuff for you. You've written the book, we'll do the stuff and stuff, and your occasional appearances. But now with the internet and global, and it's not just, it's global these days, of course. It's not like
it is
that.
And I appreciated it, and it's a very humbling process, because as a writer, when an editor tells me that we need more of this or we need to do that, and I really suspended my own thoughts and ideas at the moment, and I said, you know what, let's just take it there and see where it goes, kind of trusting the process. And I'd say 98% of the time it was always best that I listened.
Right. Now you've got this book out, has the writing bug hit a bit more? Are you thinking about doing something else, writing a fiction novel or something like that now?
I am writing right now. There's not a day that goes by that I don't write. But I don't think I'm into fiction right now. I'm still into nonfiction.
Right.
That's really where my passion lies. So I'm going to pursue that a little more. I am retiring in a couple months, so I will spend a lot more time, I would like to say, with my pen, but it's really my keyboard.
Right. See, this is it. See, go say about with your pen. I've been saying for about 5 years now that the reason that more doctors are writing novels is people, because they've all got laptops, people don't have to try and read their writing anymore when they're typing.
You can understand what
exactly they're saying. Exactly. So I think that's right and parcel, part and parcel of it. When you were growing up, you said you've got an elder brother.
Yeah.
Did he pick up on any of this? Did it affect him at all?
He had a different experience, and he did not know the experience that I went through. We were almost 7 years apart.
Uh-huh.
So by the time I came into my own realization, he was pretty much out of the house. But he did read my book, and we have not really talked at length about it. But I asked him a couple things because I wanted to know his perception, and he concurred with me. But we haven't spent a lot of time talking about it. What is interesting, though, is that he does not remember his younger brother.
Really?
And my older brother was about 5.5 when Jeffrey died.
Wow.
So often at that time, kindergarten, we do have some memories.
Yeah.
So I can only assume that it was such a traumatic time.
Blocked it out. Yeah, that's interesting, because that's what I was going to ask that, because to see if that affected him like that, but it obviously did. As you say, you do subconsciously block these things out, don't you? Apart from writing the book, you also sort of, you've got your blog, and I think you contribute to Psychology Today, is it?
Psychology Today and Inner Self, that's right.
And what sort of stuff do you write on there?
I write on different areas of reflections, just kind of observations about life. The one I wrote about time and about aging, about general issues that we can all connect with, about motherhood, the legacy of the way in which I grew up. So knowing that my audience can relate to it for many of the same themes that we all experience.
What about?
I'm just trying to be as honest as possible.
What about sort of self-confidence? Is that something that it sort of affected you earlier that you've had to learn to improve on?
Yes. I did not have a lot of confidence, and I was always in awe of people when they would just innately know that they were intelligent. I did not know that. I felt that I had to work very hard for the A's I got. and that oftentimes when I did well, I thought I was just lucky. And I still don't have that innate feeling that I am intelligent, but I've had enough people tell me that I have to kind of trust who they
right.
are because I respect them. So I kind of act as if, although it's certainly better because I'm, you know, getting on and in age, and I'm thinking, if I don't get it now, when am I going to get it? So a lot of these issues that would bother me when I was younger, I like to say that they're on the back burner and the volume is really low.
Right.
I can't say that they're going to disappear completely, but they don't define me anymore.
Do you get to a stage, I mean, when you grow up in that sort of environment, it's things you don't do so good. You know, I'm not doing this good, I'm not going to get... Instead of perhaps emphasizing on, yes, I can do this very well, I can do this very well. Is there sort of that type of scenario in that sort of environment that you concentrate on the things that you should, yeah, that you don't do well rather than the things you do well?
I actually felt that there was one area in my life that I did well that separated me from my family of origin, and that was school. And so that's really where I focused my time.
Okay.
So it's kind of the opposite of that. My brother was never a student. My parents never went to college. None of my close family of origin did. I had one great uncle who did, and an aunt. But other than that, college was not a focus for me. So that became my mission. It's interesting how we can carve out differences. You know, sometimes people look to behavior that is less than helpful
right.
in one's life. I chose academics, and I literally would cry over a B+. I needed to get an A or an A-. So that's how I really created my own niche.
Well, I tell you what, you've created your own niche on this show. It's been fascinating chatting to you. But what I'm going to do now is hand the show over to you, Barbara, so you can tell everybody where they can find out more about you and, of course, your book.
Thank you. So my name is Barbara Jaffe. My website is, I will spell it, Barbara Ann Jaffe, BarbaraAnnJaffe.com. And my book is, When Will I Be Good Enough? A Replacement Child's Journey to Healing.
Well, Barbara, thank you so much. Good luck with the book. And I'm sure a lot of people picked up on the book today. And we'll be following up on that. Very interesting. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Barry, very much for having me.
My pleasure. Well, there you go. My guest today, Barbara Jaffe. And as she said, her website, Barbara Ann Jaffe, it's A-N-N, no E at the end, Barbara Ann Jaffe, and Jaffe is J-A-F-F-E. And we've been talking about her really interesting book, which is about her life, really, basically. Well, of course it is. When Will I Be Good Enough? A Replacement Child's Journey to Healing. Fascinating insight into that sort of environment. Well, I'll be back again tomorrow, but until then...